Many of you, I was trying to get some inspiration, to get an idea of what I will be talking about today. So I looked towards the heavens so that I'm in search of some inspiration, and actually inspiration appeared. I saw this picture, and I saw that the sky was blue, we had the tree leaves that were green, and there was this cloud, and as in any nice sunny day, it was white. And I wondered, why are clouds white? Actually, this wasn't the first time that I made this question to myself, and I recalled reading somewhere that it was due to misscattering. Like many optics textbooks refer that name, misscattering, to explain why clouds are white, why milk is white, and various other properties of colloidal suspensions. But they don't get into any detail about it. So I decided it was a good chance to look at it. And in the process, I found the reason why it is only referred and they don't go any further. So first, let's go to the basics. We have our cloud, and we have here the sun. We have the light rays emitted by the sun that are white, because it has almost all frequencies. And if we see the cloud white, it's because light scattered by it, it's white too. So what remains to answer is, why is the light scattered by the cloud white? So to explain this, we use misscattering. But actually, this gentleman, Gustav Mie, a German physicist, wasn't worried at all about why clouds were white. He was worried about colloidal suspensions of gold. Because during his period, there was no explanations. When you have colloidal suspensions of gold in water, the color of it changes basically with the size of the particles. And at that time, they only had Rayleigh scattering that could only explain the scattering, like more of blue light. But in colloidal suspensions of gold, we would have red-colored suspensions and green and yellow. And there was no explanation for it. Gustav Mie also had a PhD student that was trying to made experiment research in colloidal suspensions of gold. So Gustav Mie tried to tackle this problem. So this is a picture from the original paper. I won't try to say the German name of the article, but his contributions to the optical, to the optics of turbid media, especially colloidal metal suspensions. So that you get an idea, this article is 63 pages long, so it's quite long and very technical paper, and it has more than 4,500 citations, so it's a huge impact and very influential article. So what did Mie try to do? First, imagine we have water and we have gold particles in it. And the shape of the particles could be very different. We could have like definite crystals or like defective crystals. But he decided, as any good physicist, to waive all those complications and decided to assume that all particles were perfect spheres, which is a nice idea. Although he noticed in his work, in the conclusions, that assuming only spheroidal shape wouldn't be enough, and that he should try to pursue further into ellipsoidal shape. But he never actually got to do that work, probably just because it would be a very intensive workload. So it basically reduces the problem to scattering of an electromagnetic plane wave by a sphere. Here we have our gold particle, we have an incident plane wave, and we have here the scattered wave. So, and of course, he said that the surrounding medium would be a refractive index and O, and the refractive index of the particle, he allowed it to be a complex number so that it could account for absorption phenomena and conduction as it would appear in a gold particle, a metallic particle. So what he did was pretty straightforward. It was basically what any of us would try to do. He started from Maxwell's equations. As it was a problem with spherical symmetry, he used spherical coordinates. He assumed harmonic time dependence, and he just imposed usual continuity conditions on the surface of the sphere, and he used separation of variables. But the thing is that you have an incident plane wave, you have a scattered wave inside the gold particle, and a scattered wave outside the gold particle. And when you try to match all these conditions in the surface, it becomes a very technical and very very technical problem. So the solution is very long and very evolved. And so I won't go through it because it's very complicated and it took Gustav Mie like 63 pages to do it. So I won't be talking about it, and that's why only the name is referenced and not the actual work. But in the end, the final solution is given as a series, as an infinite sum of Bessel functions for radial part, and with the polar part is given by Legendre polynomials, as usual in these sorts of problems. But actually, Mie's work wasn't that such a breakthrough, because the same problem has already been solved by plenty of other physicists before him. Thomson addressed the problem, solved the problem, but only for a perfectly conducting sphere. Arnold allowed for the conductance to be finite, and he essentially solved the same problem as Mie. Ehrenhaft and Debye also solved the same problem as Mie, but with some slightly different way that these guys say it was a more elegant way. I haven't checked it, so I don't know. And Lorentz also solved the same problem using ether theory. So why is it that Mie's solution, that Mie's paper is so cited and so influential when all these other guys also have done the same thing? Basically, it's the way that he presented the solution. He figured out some recursion formulas so that he could write the final solution, the infinite series, in a way that's more suited for practical numerical computations. So nowadays there are lots of computer programs that use Mie theory in order to calculate scattering phenomena in aerosol physics or atmospheric or colloidal physics. So that's why there's so many citations. Another importance of Mie's work is that he also addressed lots of examples in his work and pretty much explained all the data that was available at the time regarding colloidal suspensions of gold particles. So I won't get into details of the formulas because they aren't that much enlightening. So I'll just resume highlight some of the main points of Mie scattering. And I think that finds surprising is that when you get to the limit of point-like particles, we recover the result that the scatter intensity is proportional to 1 over lambda to the fourth, where lambda is the wavelength of the incident wave. It's basically like the same as Rayleigh scattering, and I find it a bit surprising because here we are considering scattering of a sphere, a dielectric sphere, like bulk properties, and when Rayleigh scattering is deduced, it's usually more with an electromagnetic wave interacting with a dipole, and they have dipole radiation. So pretty different approaches, but they get the same result, which is kind of nice in my opinion. And the important thing, like from our starting point for the clouds, is that for particles that are slightly greater than the wavelength of the incident light, the scattering becomes nearly virtually independent of the wavelength lambda. So if you have white light into the cloud, it will scatter also white light. So basically, sunlight is white, so also clouds will scatter white light, and hence they are white. Another thing that is important, and that Mie noticed in his work, is that as particle size increases, the forward scattering increases. So here we have some polar diagrams from the original paper by Mie, and here we have the case of a point-like particle. So the distribution of the scattered radiation is pretty much the same as the for Rayleigh scattering. But as the particle size increases, we see that the lobe forms in the forward direction, and it starts becoming more forward scattering increases. So, as a conclusion, the white color of clouds is due to Mie scattering. Mie theory treats scattering by spherical particles of any size. Like, if you can get like a very big particle, the electric properties, Mie scattering still applies. The only thing is if you are trying to deal with colloidal suspensions, if size of the particle starts to be too large, its shape starts being important, so it will break down. It's also important to notice that if we go to very small particles, the refractive index, which is a bulk property, like will no longer have a bulk property, so we have to look into the nanoscale properties of those particles. But for our problem, for the size of our wave droplets, that is more or less 10 microns, Mie scattering depends weakly on wavelength, so pretty much all the light as it's incident will be scattered in the same way. So for water droplets, all light scattered almost in the same way, hence clouds are white. And that's all I had to say to you. Thanks for listening.
So why are rain clouds flat?
I think that's mainly because there is also some absorption on the cloud, so it also leaves a shadow. And I think that's when we have a very tall cloud, the upper part of the cloud will cast shadow to the bottom of it. And I think that this makes sense, because on an airplane, when we are above the clouds, I've never seen a black cloud. From up? Oh, so probably this breaks down. Okay.
From the top?
Yeah, well, I think what may have been happening was that the sun was low in the sky, just casting shadows from higher clouds onto the lower clouds.
Oh, okay. Okay. Or I could just be lucky and never went with bad weather, and the explanation that I gave was totally false.
I know you say that the sun consists of all the colors, so it's white, but the sun is really a bit yellow, so why aren't clouds a little yellow?
Yes, actually the sunlight, the main frequency that is emitted is greenish yellow. But when we actually look to the sky, to the sun, we see it a little bit more yellow than it is, and I think that it's due to Rayleigh scattering, because we will have blue a little bit scattered, so the light that comes to us loses a bit of its blue part and it becomes yellower. I think it's because of that.
If you don't have any more questions, let's thank Bruno. Our next speaker is Antti from Finland.
Good day, everyone. My name is Antti Kaltson, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the soda can stay on tab. Let's at first discuss the outline of my presentation. First, we're going to see what a stay on tab really is, and also discuss a little bit about its history. After that, we're going to go and take a look at the basic physics behind levers, leverage. And after that, we're going to discuss the lid of the soda can itself, because it's a bit special too. So it's not only about the ring. And in the end, we're going to just briefly summarize everything I've talked about today. So, a soda can tab. Well, the stay-on tab is basically just the opening mechanism each of us has used, or at least seen. It was invented by Dan Kutzik in 1975 to replace the old version of it. He was a professor who worked for a company called Reynolds Metals. So basically it was invented to replace this old one, which is called the pull tab. And the reason is that in the old days, and somewhere in the world in these days too, the tabs used to be such that when the can was opened, you were basically left with a can and a little sharp piece of metal that people would just throw away. And these were, in fact, a real problem in the 60s and early 70s, because animals would ingest them, and because of that suffer a painful death, basically. And these sharp pieces of metal caused injuries both to humans and animals when stepped on. And there were literally hundreds and thousands of these lying everywhere. And everybody who's ever tried to use a metal detector to find things has definitely found some of these too, everywhere you go. So the stay-on tab is easy and safe to use, because there are no sharp edges except for the rim of the hole in the can. And it's also very simple. The design is simple, so it's easy. And cheap to mass produce, which is important because there are these cans are made in such large quantities. So, let's talk a little bit about leverage, and I'll start off with a legendary quote, and I'll read it out loud. "Give me a lever long enough and a fulcrum on which to place it, and I shall move the world." So said Archimedes, and he was the one credited for the mathematical groundwork for levers. He didn't invent leverage, but he was the one who did the math. The formula here for torque is just to remind everybody, and it's also pretty self-explanatory, except maybe for the R vector, which is basically the vector from the fulcrum to the point where the force is applied on the lever. And from the formula, it's easy to see that the lever can be used to amplify, or in some cases also to de-amplify the force one exerts on the lever. But in our case, it is used to amplify the force one exerts on the can when opening it. There are basically three different kinds or classes of levers. The first class is the one where the fulcrum is located between the applied force and the load. And as an example of this, I have Finnish scissors. I think you have this in America too. So you exert the force on the handle, and the load is here between the blades. And everybody knows from self-experience that the closer the stuff or material you want to cut is to the hinge point of the scissors, the easier it is to cut it. As a second example, class two of the levers is where the load is situated between the fulcrum and the force. And as an example, I have the wheelbarrow. And like everybody who has used one of these knows, the closer the load is to the wheel, the easier the wheelbarrow is to push around, lighter to lift up. And the third class is where the force is applied between the fulcrum and the load. And as an example, I have tweezers. And, well, basically, this means that the harder you want to squeeze something with this, the closer to the load, which is here, you want to apply the force. So in this definition, the stay on tab is a class one lever, basically. As you can see from the picture, the here is the fulcrum point, and here you is the load, so the point where the ring touches the lid. And here you apply the force where on the ring that where you pull from. So now let's just assume that the force you apply is perfectly perpendicular to the ring, just to make things simpler and to get a qualitative result. I measured this with a ruler. R1 and R2, you can see from the picture. And R1 is roughly four times longer than R2, which means that the force you apply on the can is quadrupled. So basically, the ring pushes down four times harder than you pull it up from the other end. But in addition to this, the lid itself is a little bit special. It has to be scored, because even with a lever, it would be very hard to make a hole through a solid aluminum lid. So there's a little groove here, and it has to be very precisely made. It must not be too deep or not too shallow, because if the score is too deep, then the can open by itself because of the internal pressure. Like everybody knows, PV equals NRT. Well, it might not be an ideal gas, but it'll give you some feel of it. And also, if you shake the can and release the carbon dioxide, which is in the liquid, it might increase the pressure inside and make the can open by itself, which could cause trouble and at least make a huge mess. And well, if you make it too shallow, then it's basically just a solid piece of aluminum and hard to make a hole through. And the score thing is made also to ensure that the hole is large enough for a pleasant drinking experience. The lid and the tab, they're both manufactured separately. So is the rest of the can. So basically, a soda can is made out of three parts. And the lid itself, it's made of a different alloy than the rest of the can. And it's because the lid is flat, so it has to be very rigid and strong to stand the pressure, in contrast to the bottom, which is concave, to stand pressure better. So, to summarize things, the little puny stay-on tap has taken us through Archimedes. He did the groundwork thousands of years ago. And we also have to know something about pressure. So we have to thank Clapeyron for this. Also, the manufacturing process is a feat of modern engineering, because to give you some feel of this, in the early 1990s, 100 billion aluminum cans were made each year in the US alone. So there are a lot of these out there all around the world. But above all, the whole thing is all about human curiosity and ingenuity, which are the two main reasons why we are all here. Thank you.
It's just stunning to me how complicated something like this is, and yeah, how cheaply that you can manufacture so cheaply that it's worthwhile. You showed the one picture you showed of the top view where you can see the scoring right there.
Yeah.
There's two scoring lines there. Do you know why that is?
I actually know, but I think that there are different kinds of them too.
Okay.
There are. I've also seen ones where there is only one line.
Okay.
I'm not sure why, but it might have something to do with the process and the factory where these are made. So different companies may use different kinds of scoring techniques. I'm not sure.
Why is that? That other shape on the top of the can as well? Is that just aesthetic, or is that part of the mechanical design?
Excuse me?
Is this kind of triangular shape encompassing the hole and the thing for opening it? Not on the top of the can then?
Here?
Yeah. So the top of the can is circular, and then there's this shape.
Oh, yeah.
The indentation that you have at the top there.
Yeah.
I don't know. I've understood that they are made by pressing or compressing metal, so it might have something to do with the shape of the machine that they use to do them. I'm not sure.
Okay.
Yeah?
Do you know how often bullets fail and how often cans do disperse?
Yeah. I don't remember the source where I read this from, but one in 50,000 cans is not good. On average.
Is this technology, is that a patent or something like that?
I believe it is.
Have there been any other improvements to it recently, or has the design stayed exactly the same?
There have been some... they have tried to improve it, but this has prevailed every time.
Well, let's thank Antti again.
My name is Neva, and I'm going to talk to you a little bit about how bicycles stay upright. So I'm going to discuss first simply how people when people think about it, you know, naively, how do they think bicycles stay up when moving, and some possible explanations. I'm going to go through some experimental tests that were done by David Jones, unpublished in Physics Today in 1970. And finally, I'm going to, you know, show what his discuss what his results were. So I was inspired to do this while going on our walk. We walk every day here on the Trans-Canada Trail, and there's lots of people riding bicycles. And I remembered that a few weeks earlier, one of my friends, we were going on a walk, and he asked me, you know, you're a physicist. Why is it when a bicycle is stationary, it's so easy to fall over, but when it's moving, it's very easy to keep it upright while moving. So what are some possible explanations for this? So is it centrifugal force? When you start to feel yourself leaning over, you sort of steer in the direction of the lean, and then that'll produce a centrifugal force outward that'll push you upright again. And another idea is gyroscopic motion due to the rotation of the wheels. So they have an angular momentum. Once again, when the wheels start to tilt, there'll be a torque, but once again, back the other way. So just these were some simple ideas people had when they tried to think about how bicycles stay upright. So one idea is you have a rolling hoop. You know, it does wobble, but it can still roll. It curves, and then it still stays upright. So shouldn't a bicycle be similar? So to try out the effects of that gyroscopic idea, one thing David Jones did was he made a bicycle that had an extra wheel on it that could rotate in the opposite direction of the wheel, and so thereby canceling out this gyroscopic force. So so if this gyroscopic motion were explaining how the bicycle stayed upright, then you shouldn't be able to ride this when the wheel is rotating the opposite direction. But you know, you can see he was still able to ride it. So basically that's not enough to explain why the bicycle stays upright. And once again, to talk about that centrifugal force idea, I mean, staying upright doesn't really depend on, you know, following a curved trajectory and, you know, centrifugal force pushing you back that way. So that's not really a good explanation either. But that's another thing too. It has to do it's simply that there are gyroscopic forces at play, but it's simply not enough to keep, you know, a whole person on a bicycle upright while it's moving, because, you know, the front wheel is so light that, you know, it doesn't produce that much of a torque while rotating. So that's one thing he did. He pushed this bicycle, and it was indeed more stable when the wheel is rotating in the same direction as the normal wheels, but it fell over immediately when he pushed it and it's rotating the opposite direction. Okay, wait. So the next thing, this is again from David Jones, Physics Today, 1970. These are some different things he tried. Now, he thought about the steering geometry. So what's going on here? We have, right here we have the steering axis is tilted with respect to the wheel. So the wheel is out here, and once again, this is curved a little bit. In most bicycles, you have this curve right here. So in effect, what's actually happening is the contact point with the ground is ahead of the steering axis. So what happens is that it's like the steering mechanism that operates to reduce the gravitational potential rather than these other kinds of forces. So he tried, he ran some computerized calculations that I won't go into detail. I mean, I didn't entirely understand, but to try and figure out which was the best kind of steering geometry and which would produce extremely unstable bicycles. So one thing he tried was one with the axis reversed, and it curves backwards instead of forwards. So he found that that kind of bicycle was pretty awkward to ride, but when you just pushed it without a rider, it was extremely stable, which was kind of weird. So the other thing he did, he found from his calculations that this kind of bicycle with, you know, the steering, the wheel much in front of the steering axis would be unstable, and indeed it was like almost impossible to ride. So basically what he found in conclusion is that, so the naively what comes to mind when you think about how a bicycle stays upright while moving, those forces don't play an extremely large role. And it's rather a much larger role is played by the geometry of the steering. Okay, wait. Yeah. Any questions?
You said there's a reason why the bicycle stays still not due to central role.
I mean, it plays some of a role, but it doesn't play, you know, it doesn't play it.
You try to to curve, you don't steer your, you don't steer the...
Yeah, you lean.
You lean yourself inside. Mm-hmm. In that case, if you had a bicycle wheel down, like that, going in an opposite direction, then actually bicycle wheel, what would that be if you tried to
lean? If you tried to lean? Okay, I think he did... I don't think he tried that, but like he did try riding these bicycles, so it was maybe a bit more, maybe he tried that wheel, and he tried like engineering like a three-wheeled bicycle like with a certain amount of lean in it, and it's explained a bit more in the article, but anyway, and there's a lot more discussion on this beyond what I looked into, but I thought it was pretty cool. So wait, so you're, if I can, did I answer your question? I don't know. Yeah, so leaning has an effect.
I thought that by leaning it would be like conservation of angular momentum that will go like this. So
yeah.
I was wondering if you have the...
That is part of the turning, but that's maybe, that's not why you stay, you know, that's not why you stay upright when you go. You don't turn, you don't, you know, lean back and forth, really. You do that to turn, though.
Well, so doesn't the distance from the pivot have to do with how far the wheel has to turn in order to get you upright again? Because if you're far behind, it has to kind of lean further into the turn to get you back upright. While if it's close, it only has to turn a little bit, so the torque is less. So don't you think that the angular momentum does play a role, but the design of the of the steering just helps the angular momentum a lot?
Well, I mean, yeah, there's a lot of, I mean, there's angular momentum, but it's not like, it's not the, I think what it is that it's not the torque from the wheel tilting. That's basically what he's saying. Or it's not the, it's not the torque produced by the wheel rotating.
If you solve the problem of a coin or a wheel in mechanics rolling like this on the vertical, and if you slightly disturb the motion, if the translation velocity is high enough, it will become a stable movement.
Mm-hmm.
It won't fall.
Yeah.
So,
So I think it's like the point is that there's like more going on with a bicycle than with, it's not like the same thing as something.
The gyroscopic effect on the bicycle, I mean, as may correctly stated, is a very small part of the whole thing, and in fact it's something that people try to avoid very much, right? I mean, the rolling weight, and when you talk about bicycle design, the rolling weight of the bicycle is much worse for being fast at moving a bike than the dead weight on a bicycle. And so if you want a nimble bike that you can respond very quickly with, you have very, very light wheels, and that's entirely the gyroscopic effect. But the rest is mostly this other component.
Yeah, I still want to understand it better, but I had, you know, a taste that it was more interesting than I, you know, had imagined. Because when my friend asked me, I basically said, something to do with angular momentum. Yeah.
Well, let's thank Dave again. Our next speaker is Matt, and he's going to tell us about frisbees. It's a very outdoorsy session.
Okay, my name is Matt, and I'm going to talk a little bit about Frisbee, which is something a little bit near and dear to my heart, a game that I like to play a lot. The talk's going to go like this. First, I'm going to give a little bit of background about Frisbee and flying discs in general. Then I'm going to put a picture on the board and talk about all the forces that are involved in this picture. Then I'm going to talk about the physics of a general flying object of that shape, namely drag and lift. Then I'm going to go into what happens because the frisbee or the disc is rotating, and that involves some gyroscopic precession as well, just like we saw in the last talk, and I'll do some concluding remarks. So frisbee is started out, there's this guy named William Frisbee in Bridgeport, Connecticut. In 1871, he started a bakery, and legend has it that students from one Yale University, which is pretty nearby, liked to buy pies from this bakery, and they would turn the pie tins over and throw them around because they were brilliant and discovered that it was aerodynamic. Then it was later marketed as a toy by Wham-O in the 1950s, and today it's starting to gain a ton of popularity, especially in the last 10 years. There is a world frisbee competition every year, played in 42 countries. In the United States, nearly 30,000 members of this organization. So it's really an up-and-coming sport, definitely something worth figuring out the physics of. So here's a very basic diagram of a frisbee. Has all of the factors that one would expect. It's tilted slightly because in order to get the maximum distance or to get an accurate throw with the frisbee, you need to have an angle of attack, which is that alpha there. And that's sort of the force that you're exerting on the frisbee is going to be slightly upward as well as forward. And as a result, there's some lift there, which is this L, and there's also drag. And of course, gravity pulling frisbee down. So just to get a little bit of an intuitive picture about the flight of a frisbee, frisbees can actually travel farther than a thrown ball because they're so resistant to vertical velocity. So rather than falling out of the sky, a frisbee is always going to drift out of the sky. And so this is a diagram of that. So now I'm going to show a little bit of a video of how frisbees fly. And the first one I'm going to show was on ESPN a little bit ago, which is pretty exciting for a frisbee player. So this is, see how the frisbee just floats in the air very stably? And I'll show one more. This is an Alaskan, actually, and this is incredibly impressive in my mind. So again, the frisbee can go a lot farther because it's so resistant to vertical.
Anyway. Okay, back to the
All right, so let's take a look at the physics a little bit more closely. Let's look at the drag. First, we need to figure out what the Reynolds number is, because this is going to decide what regime the drag force is in. So this is the expression for the Reynolds number. It's the density of air times the velocity of the object that's moving through the air times the diameter of the object over the viscosity there. And putting in the appropriate values for air, frisbee flying at about 15 meters per second, and the diameter of a frisbee is about 8 to 10 inches, you get this number, which is quite high. And as a result, that means that the drag force can be determined with this expression here, which is attributed, again, to Lord Rayleigh. And it's actually a pretty simple expression, except for this coefficient here, the coefficient of drag, which depends on the makeup of the object. And actually, frisbee has a pretty complicated shape. And also, it has a quadratic relationship with the angle of attack that I was describing earlier. So moving on to lift, we heard a little bit about this yesterday when these guys were talking about curving soccer ball. But here with a frisbee is almost exactly like a wing. So the air moving over a wing or a disc on top moves more quickly than the air moving under it. And that means that the pressure above the moving object is lower and then the pressure under it, and that creates a lift force propelling the frisbee upwards. And the reason for that pressure relationship is here, the Bernoulli equation. But it turns out that this isn't quite enough to explain this, because we don't really know why the air above the frisbee or the wing is moving more quickly than the air under it. There's an explanation that sort of appeals to us intuitively, that there's a longer distance over the frisbee or the wing than there is under it, and that's why it's moving faster. But then you wouldn't be able to throw a frisbee upside down or fly a plane upside down, which you can do, we know. So that's not quite right. Turns out that the real solution has something to do with circulation, which around a frisbee or wing is actually very complicated. And you have this Kutta-Joukowsky equation, which involves this gamma here, which is the circulation, it's a line integral around the entire object as the circulation of the air is involved. So it's actually pretty complicated to calculate the lift force here. another view that maybe simplifies the matter for our minds is what Newton thought of this matter, which is just that, well, there are molecules of air that are bouncing off of the lower surface of the wing or the frisbee, and that has to be exerting a force on the frisbee. Well, the frisbee has to be exerting a force on these air molecules in order to deflect them. And that means that the air must be exerting an equal and opposite force on the frisbee, keeping it up in the air. Well, we might run into a problem here. And that's because the frisbee is spinning. And that means that just as before, the air on the top of the frisbee was moving more quickly than the air below it, that means that the air on, if you're spinning it clockwise, the air on the left side of the frisbee is going to be moving more quickly than the air on the right. Well, if we use the same argument, that means that there's going to be a torque on the frisbee that tends to have it list to one side. So if I throw the frisbee like this, you've seen this, if someone throws a frisbee poorly, it all sort of goes up in the air and then crashes back into the earth like that, or it starts to wobble because it's not spinning. That means that this flight of the frisbee is not stable. And we need something to counter that tendency to skew one way or the other. And that is provided by gyroscopic precession. So if you deliver sufficient spin to a frisbee, then the disc is going to precess just like a gyroscope would. And it's going to resist strongly any desire to list to one side or the other, just like a gyroscope would. And that means that when the frisbee is flying through the air and it's spinning the disc is moving faster on one side than it is on the other, it will say, okay, I want to move to that, I want to bend to that side, but the gyroscopic precession is stopping it from being able to do that. And that means that the faster that you spin a frisbee when you throw it, the more stable that frisbee is going to be. And so when you're talking about throwing technique, the number one thing to say is not, don't try to throw the frisbee hard. You want to try to spin it as much as you can. And that way you can exert very little effort, and actually the frisbee will go a long way. So what have we learned about frisbees today? It's like a combination between a wing and a gyroscope. Just like a plane's wing, the Frisbee relies on lift in order to stay in the air comfortably. And just like a gyroscope, it's a stable rotation because of the angular momentum involved in the precession. And so the most important factors that we have in distance or hang time are these three: the initial velocity, the angle of attack, but also the angular momentum. Thank you. So there's more weight on the outside of the Frisbee because you have the rim, and that also helps with grip so that you can deliver the spin that you need to. But it isn't like those hollow Frisbees that you see used with dogs. I imagine that that's because if you go too far in that direction, you don't have enough lift. You want to have a thick enough middle of the Frisbee for it to float well. That's just conjecture, though. They put a lot of thought into designing these. Frisbees are standard 175 grams. Like, if it's not 175 grams, you can't play with it. Like, that sort of thing.
So why is it that if you take your, you know, your margarine container lid or your yogurt lid, you throw it and it just right away goes off like this, where the Frisbee stays very nice and straight? Is that all, again, the mass distribution of the outside?
Well, it's that and however much spin you're delivering. So if you just have like a lid like this, you're not really going to be able to make it rotate very quickly. The Frisbee has a lip that sort of goes under like this, so you can really get a good grip on it. And when you flick your wrist, it spins very, very quickly. So the angular momentum that you're delivering on the object is actually quite a lot in order for it to be stable.
You kind of gave two reasons for the lip, right? One of them is just the airplane wing renewal thing. And the other one was a simplified Newton. Right. But those are two very different explanations. So which and both are reasonable explanations in my mind. So which one is more important and why?
I think that that you can get an accurate result to an extent with either one. If you want a more accurate, the first one is definitely the way to go because it's taking into account the air circulation around the Frisbee, which is actually a pretty important effect as I understand it. But it's just very difficult to calculate, and intuitively it makes sense for us to think of Newton's law, so I included that as well.
Yeah, sure. Is there more separation at the top of the wing going back to the dark forming a low pressure system at the top? Just separation.
Separation?
Yeah, so does the wind blowing across the top of the airfoil separate before the end of the run?
I'm not sure. I really don't know. I mean, Frisbees have a pretty symmetric shape, so I'm not sure that that's really a factor there. I'm not certain, though. Yeah, it's pretty thin.
Let's move on to the next speaker.
Hi, everyone. Well, we already had Bruno talking about clouds already, and I think it's a subject that interests, well, many of us, as I at least like to imagine. So, and here I'm going to let you on with a bit of motivation on the talk, and then talk about clouds in general, and why do they look the way they do. Then check a bit about clouds on other planets, just to compare. So, here's a little quote that I'd like you to read yourself, because there's words that I can't pronounce. So, if some of you don't already know Mandelbrot, or would you even pronounce it, he's done a lot of work with fractal geometry, which is something that if you don't know about, then Google it or something. It's really interesting. So here's one description how clouds will form and what they look like by Mandelbrot, and I found it quite cute. So what are clouds? I bet you have already seen them. They are these huge things on the sky, usually white, as Bruno was kind enough to explain us why. And from the picture, we also can see that they appear a bit grayish, just like Felix noticed that this picture is also taken from a plane, so they look grayish from there too. But basically, we can call them white. So clouds consist of a vast collection of either tiny droplets of liquid water or small crystals of ice. Of course, a cloud can have both of those. But if you have only like tiny droplets of liquid water, we can call that cloud like a warm cloud. This is not that important to know, but I just like to mention it. And the cold clouds are called cold clouds, which is nice. So why do we have clouds? Why are they hanging up there all the time? Well, we have water all around the world. This is a picture that I made yesterday. And we have sun warming the water. And then, of course, the water vaporizes into the air. This does not yet form a cloud. But then the sun warms the humid air, and the air turns red because it's, well, warmer. And as we know, warm, humid air is much lighter than cold air, from which it follows that the warm, humid air rises high, and when it reaches a high point, it spreads around. And because it's much colder up there than it is down here, the air cools and the vaporized water forms into droplets. So, ta-da, we have a cloud. So, next question is, why don't the clouds fall down? Because if they are made of droplets or like ice crystals, wouldn't we like first think that they would fall down? Because, well, Newton already told us so, that things with a mass fall down. Well, they actually do fall down. The reason why they still stay up is because the airflow that, well, creates them to begin with, same time pushes them upwards. And this actually comes to Bruno's presentation, when there was this model that expected the droplets to be round. Well, it's a good approximation, but the airflow actually causes the water droplets to be this shape. I'm not sure if you can see it right, because I didn't make the background dark enough. But as you can see, it's easier for show me by hand, there's this little concave shape to it when the air pushes it up. And from the shape of the water droplet, we can go and think about why clouds appear in different shapes. We've seen lots of different kinds of clouds around the sky. Well, we actually saw already one reason for it. There are different kinds of particles that that the clouds consist of, and they can also be in different kind of temperatures. So we have the icy clouds that appear, I can't pronounce that next word, but they look very soft and thin, kind of. So they consist of those, well, little icy crystals that we were already talking about. And then the warm clouds, they are these softer looking clouds, something that you might imagine yourself like jumping on and sleeping on and like hugging it or something like that. And then there's the altitude. So starting from the bottom, we can see that the low clouds are looks like this. I think you can see it. I don't have to describe it. So here we have it's the same kind of cloud that I had in the previous picture. And when we go upwards, it kind of breaks down to little pieces. And when we're right here in the high clouds, we can see that they are more, that difficult word. How do you pronounce it? Anyone? Tenuous?
Tenuous.
Tenuous? Okay, thank you. The English lessons. So when we are this high, I get a good example from really high clouds, not delusive clouds. Anyone can help me with this word also. So these look like this. Again, very tenuous, and they are, well, of course, icy clouds, being so high up in the air. Actually, this picture isn't mine. This is from the internet. It's taken in Finland. We have these huge lakes over there, so that's from there. And then there are actually the highest clouds in Earth's atmosphere, and this picture is also from just from the internet. It's from Estonia, but the same thing. This is how high they really are. So that's like very high, and you could wonder how can we like see it during the night. And here's a good picture that explains it all. Because the clouds are visible only when illuminated by sunlight from below the horizon. Well, it's good enough. While the lower layers of the atmosphere are in Earth's shadow. So this dark thing here is the shadow that Earth like makes when sunlight comes from here. And this is your eye looking up in the sky, seeing the nocturnal clouds here. So you have a night time here, and you still see clouds. I think that's pretty cool. So let's go even higher and see what clouds look on other planets. Well, of course, Mercury doesn't have any clouds. It's so close to the sun, and everything just vaporizes, and it's also a very small planet, so let's see what Venus looks like. So, sulfur dioxide and drops of sulfuric acid. Sounds bad, but it looks really cool. But the clouds there are completely opaque, so if you were down at the surface of a planet, you couldn't like see the sky. Then we have Mars. I like the picture. Again, pictures are from the internet. I haven't been there. Actually, the atmosphere has only a trace of water vapor, but still the pressure and the heat there is such that it's able to be, it's possible to exist clouds there. Then we have Saturn. This is my favorite. I really like the clouds there. There are like three kinds of, what do you call them, layers or types of clouds. One that is from ammonia, and then there's ammonia hydrosulfide, and then there's also water clouds. And then the two left ones are quite similar, so methane crystals, and they form these clouds that we see here. So, in conclusion, we now know that clouds are not just vaporized water. They are water droplets and ice crystals. We also know that we have clouds in different altitudes. And clouds can consist of different kinds of particles, as I already mentioned. And then I'd like to say that, well, of course, there are clouds on other planets too. They are not from icy crystals and like that. But this I'd like to just note to you, you can't jump on a cloud and stay on it. So. Thank you for listening.
So we have time for probably one question.
Yeah, Felix.
All right, I've got that. So this is noxilucent clouds.
Yeah.
But they're well out of the troposphere, aren't they?
So sorry, well.
So the troposphere, like the weary. Like
yes.
Somehow clouds are held up in that through convection and so on. But are they in the stratosphere or mixed sphere? And how do they exist? How are they held up?
Well, I'm not sure about the name of the altitude, but it was, I already wrote there that something about 76 to, was it 85 kilometers high. Does everybody know what is that altitude called? I don't know. But its resistance should be basically the same thing that keeps them there. Well, of course.
I mean, you don't get, like, you only get like convection and so on in the bottom, like
yeah.
Troposphere.
Yeah, but it still like helps them a bit up. They, I don't think they like stay up there very long. You can't see them like if you saw them yesterday. I don't think you can see them like the day after.
Unfortunately, we are.
That is another question. May I say something to change about cars, to change the meaning, because I think it's gone from somehow stale and repetitive, and everyone got somehow tired because it's long now. It's a short point. It's a short question to everyone. It's about clouds. May I ask?
Yeah.
Suppose if you have a cloud in your size, for example. But that not the real cloud, the cartoon like cloud that is fluffy and you can actually touch it and walk on it. It's touchable, okay? Suppose that you have this cloud and there is no one in the world except you and your cloud. It's a psychology question, it's not just except that you assume that there's only you and your cloud. What would you do with it?
I'd hug it.
Anyone else? Any ideas? It's actually important what you think about that. So, please.
Yeah.
not the people that have asked this question before.
Shape it into human shape.
Okay, we probably don't have more time for more response to that question, so let's move on to Shane's talk.
Zero, you didn't let me finish that.
Oh,
what's that? That's all about. You just want to keep going. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
I will tell you
later
after
the presentation.
Was the that's just the light, isn't it? Right, g'day everyone. I'm going to be talking about hydraulic jumping. And despite the fancy name, you all do know what this is. So to show you rather than tell you, here it is. This is taken in my apartment. The hydraulic jump is this ridge on the outside of the radial flow where the water rises up. And you do see it quite often in nature as well as inside the house. Usually we see it where it's forced to happen. Before I tell you about that, I'll tell you about what's actually being seen. So here we have fast flowing liquid followed by a region of slow moving fluid. And so the reason why you get the jump is just because of conservation of mass. So the slow flowing fluid has to take up more volume. So that's the most basic way of looking at things. So as I said, we see these usually where they're forced to occur. So most people are interested in energy dissipation, that sort of thing, rather than in why they occur, where they occur, if that makes sense. So, for example, we have a slope, which then goes into a less steep gradient. And so this region here is incapable of supporting the flow that this region is. And so you get the jump occurring there. I'm not interested in energy dissipation or the ratio of the height of the second region to the first region. What I'm interested in is why the radius occurs, say, here as opposed to here for a flat plate. And I couldn't really find much information, so I had to go at building a model myself. And let's see how I go. So imagine you have the flow flowing down like this. Oh, and there's another point. I wanted to be able to do an experiment and verify my theory. So imagine you've got the flow flowing down like this, got the radial region and then the jump. So things I can measure this height here, I can measure this height here, the radius of the stream, or the diameter, I can measure the flow rate, And that's about it other than the radius. And so let's see what we can do with this. The first thing that comes to mind is that the radius is stationary, right? So let's have a look at variation in momentum either side of this boundary. So the first side. All right, so one of the assumptions that I made was that the flow was going to be inviscid. There was going to be no boundary effects, no surface tension, nothing like that. And on top of that, I was going to have velocity in this first region being constant. Just some assumptions so I can do some physics because I don't really know much about these systems. So given that, you can work out that this is going to be equal to the velocity, which is constant, times this is just the density, this is just the volume of, say, a small area in here. Right? Next, I want to equate that to a variation over here. So I'm going to assume that the velocity in that second region is zero. It's not a very good assumption, but I'm going to take it anyway. And we'll see how it goes. So it's a little bit hand-wavy, right? I'm interested in the pressure. Let's rename these so they're not the same. So the pressure times the area at this space. It's maybe not a good assumption. There might be a constant out the front, but still get a sort of almost quantitative idea. All right. So I can equate these two at the boundary. Well, that's what I want to be doing anyway. And so these 2 pi r's cancel. There's a rho cancels. And I end up with V squared, change in R on T in this V here, H naught equals GH1 squared. And this is good because now I've got a ratio of these heights, right? And I can measure that. What I can't measure is this velocity here. That's kind of a pain, right? So what I'm going to do is try to get rid of that by working out what it is in terms of this flow rate, which I can measure. So just looking at the area of that stream and the area of this area, this area here, you have that the flow equals pi a squared on 4 V for that flow down there, which is also equivalent to the flow that's coming out here, which is equal to 2 pi r h v. And I can come up with a relationship between this h naught and this velocity here, and as well as the r, right? I hope. No, sorry. Yeah, that's right. The reason I've got both of them is just so I can get rid of this H naught. All right, so I've got this flow rate in terms of this velocity here, which is what I wanted. So I'm just going to sub in what I found my velocity to be up here, and I should have my answer. So flow rate equals and subbing in this H naught, I get that F is proportional to the square root of R, and there's some constants out the front. Okay, so finally I can see whether my theory is wonderful, and hopefully it will be. And I took this data with Lauren. We got this wonderful relationship, so proportional to the square root of flow rate, and I thought, yay, this is wonderful. until about 11 o'clock last night when I worked out I had the axes right the wrong way and everything's completely wrong. So, I had to go back to the drawing board at about 11 o'clock last night, and I did actually find that this wasn't such a waste of time after all, because what it tells you is that my assumptions were hideous. A better assumption is that there is viscosity, right? And that there are surface tension effects, that there are separation of boundaries. And so what's actually happening is instead of having this sort of sterile process, you actually have, if I can find the eraser, you have the stream, and you have separations occurring along with, what are these called? Vortices forming. And so you really need to take into account viscosity. And so, thank you. This analysis that was done by Tani in 1949, so I'm 60 years too late or so, used Navier-Stokes and a no-slip condition. And that no-slip condition is basically looking at the fact that these processes are symmetric, so you assume zero velocity right down here. And he found that you, in fact, do get the relationship that experimentally Laura and I derived. Yeah, so wrong, correct, but this is useful because it tells you, I guess, why we're wrong. So yeah, that's it. I hope you have a small understanding now of what a hydraulic jump is. Can I just add, the reason I did all this on the board is because I've never actually done that, so that was the reason, not to bore you all. So.
So it's more of a comment on the initial assumption, right? If you have a radial flow, then you can't have both velocity being constant and a film thickness, or h not being constant.
No, it's not. It's not constant.
So I think that's instantaneously, yeah. You look at that assumption and you go, okay, it can't be.
Yeah. Right? So another assumption that I made is that this is approximately zero as well. So it's really small. I don't know. There are a number of assumptions that are pretty hideous in here. But I mean, I didn't really. I had a night to do it, so two nights to do it, actually.
Oh, you did a nice experiment.
Yeah. But yeah.
This is another comment is, did you come across there's a very nice symmetry breaking that happens here as well? So normally at certain speeds, you get a nice circular pattern. I believe it's with higher speeds, so take your flat plate and bring it further down, and it'll break up into like a hexagonal pattern.
I know, I didn't see that.
There's some really, really interesting physics.
I saw waves that were happening around the outside.
Yeah.
But
so I think that those waves starting are the initial start of the instability that happens, and then it starts breaking up into like hexagonal and different patterns depending. It's quite stunning.
Yeah. Well, you can actually see it in this footage here. The outside sort of oscillates. That's what made a little bit harder to do the experiment, actually, these effects. Yeah. You can actually see that happening. Anyone else?
So I might have missed it, but is there any reason why there's a sudden jump in the height?
So basically, from what I've read, the surface isn't able to maintain the flow. So what happens is you get separation and of the boundary layer. If you have a pipe, right, and you have fluid flowing, it'll stop being in sort of this lamina region, I guess, and will start turbulent flow if it's a really long pipe, I believe. So it might have something to do with that. that's a guess, right? So. Sorry. No, I don't. But I can give you the paper. I've got it on my computer. If you want.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's move on to the next talk, which is about this team house. Next talk.
Okay. Can I come back?
Okay. Hi. My presentation is about rainbows. You guys probably already know all of this, but pretend you're in fourth grade for me. So my talk is going to go something like this. First, I'm going to talk about why we get rainbows in the first place. Second, I'm going to explain why we get the order of colors that we do. Third, I'm going to tell you why you see it as an arc and not as a star or circle. And then we're going to look at some double rainbows, and then we're going to have some pretty pictures. So, if you don't remember, Snell's law of refraction tells you that when light goes from one medium to another, the index of refraction tells you how much it's going to refract, and it goes according to this law. So the bigger the difference in index of refraction, the bigger the kind of difference in bend. And water actually happens to be slightly sensitive to the wavelength that you put into it. So there's this minor difference between the index of refraction of red light and blue light. I'm going to talk mostly about just red and blue because they're two extremes and everything else falls in between. So because of this, when you have light entering a raindrop, so you know, you see rainbows in the rain. When you have light entering a raindrop, this is the sun over here somewhere. And here's, it enters the raindrop, it reflects off the opposite end and refracts back here. And so you can see that since the index of refraction was a little bit bigger for the blue light than the red light, the blue light is refracted a little bit more and comes out at slightly slightly smaller angle at the end. Right, so this angle 42 that you see there, so that's the total kind of change in direction of the light from before it enters the raindrop to after it comes out. It's called the Descartes angle or rainbow angle, because that's where the brightest, that's basically the angle at which you observe it at all, because that's where the brightest light comes out. And at any angles larger than this over here, you can't see any light refracted from here at all. And over here is just smaller intensities, so they kind of combine back together and you don't see different colors either. And it's called the Descartes angle because Descartes was the first one to come up with a theory of all of this. So you might look at this and see, oh, the red's on the bottom and the blue's on the top. How come I see red on top of the rainbow and not on the bottom? Well, if you were actually looking at light from one raindrop, if you saw the red light from it, the blue light from that same raindrop would be somewhere above your head, so you wouldn't actually see it. So you, in order to see the blue light, it would have to come from a different raindrop, actually lower down. So you, the rainbow that you see is from a collection of all of the raindrops and not just one, and you see it going the other way from red to blue. So you have this Roy G. Biv. But why is it an arc? So the picture that I showed you before is a two-dimensional picture, but really light enters everywhere into this raindrop, right? And it's actually spherically symmetrical, or if you rotate it about this axis, it should happen the same way all around, right? So you'll have the same light coming out like this. So basically, as an observer, you'll see red light coming from everywhere that's 42 degrees away from you, so you have this half conical. Well, actually, you have a whole cone of from which you'll see red light, but since there's a horizon, you only see half of it like that. So you get to see an arc. So from this, it's very easy to see that if the sun is like more than 42 degrees above the horizon, then there's not really, there won't be any raindrops from which you can even see the reflection. So the light, the sun must be less than 42 degrees above the horizon. But if you go up high, like on a mountain or in an airplane, then there's more raindrops down there that you can actually see light reflected from, even if the sun is above 42 degrees. So that's why you see rainbows more often when you're higher up. So another thing that happens is sometimes you get to see the second rainbow further away. And that second rainbow is just
kind of the same effect, except when it reflects within the raindrop twice. And as you can see here, since the light is coming from, now the light is, I guess, entering the bottom of the raindrop, reflecting here, reflecting back up there, and then reflecting down like that. So everything is sort of reversed, right? So the red light is on the bottom and the blue light is on the top. And this band between the two of them, it's called Alexander's band. Wikipedia warns you not to confuse it with Alexander's ragtime band. And so that happens because, as I said before, here you won't see any light from over here. There's just small, lower intensity light coming over here, right? So that's why inside of the, oops, wrong way, inside of the rainbow, it's a little bit brighter because that's where that, the rest of that light goes. But since in this double reflection, it's kind of a little bit reversed, so here it goes blue light, red light, the rest of the light, kind of, and here it goes red light, blue light, the rest of the light the other way. So in between the two of them, it's really dark. Yeah, so there's actually, you can have light reflect inside the raindrop many times, probably. This is actually a simulation. It's really hard to see, but it's a fifth order. When it reflects inside the raindrop five times, you get to see that. And this is somewhere within that Alexander's band. If you somehow manage to see it and take a picture, you'll be able to see that. But in the lab, people have been able, using like really strong laser light, people have been able to simulate and observe like over 100 orders of magnitude of these rainbows. And in conclusion, here's rainbows from the mountain. Rainbows can be also another, not necessarily in the rain, right, over there. And rainbows are pretty. That's all I have to say.
So, in principle, how many of these rainbows can you get?
I don't know if there's an actual limit on how many you can get, because you just keep reflecting it. It's just a little more of a limit of how many you can observe.
But like every time it reflects, is there some stuff that you can't layer through? So every time it reflects, so it's important that you won't be able to see it.
Right? Yeah, exactly. So some people actually think, for some reason, that this total internal reflection is what goes on here, but it's not, there's light escaping in the distance. Yes. So wouldn't the angle, the voltage depend on the size of the droplet? Actually, no, it wouldn't, right? I mean, if the shape is different, it might change it a little bit, but it wouldn't, but I can't come up with a reason why right off the top of my head.
Well, because the angle depends on the index of refraction of water and air, so the size of the droplet would change the angle, right?
Sorry.
The angle
of refraction doesn't.
Yeah, the angle. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, like if it's bigger than the incident angle, and stuff are going to be slightly different.
No, I don't think so.
No? Oh, the incident angle, basically you have sunlight coming in everywhere here, right? And you just pick out the one that it comes out at 42 degrees, and that's the one that's the brightest. Does that make sense? So no matter what the size is, you will get one that is at 42 degrees.
Okay.
You don't believe it, right?
Yeah, no,
could you show this picture of the double rainbow? There's a darkness space between them. Rainbows, but why is the air much brighter, like beneath the rainbow? You can also observe this on a small vertical space.
Oh,
the air seems to be much brighter on the outside than on the inside of the rainbow.
Well, it's because the same thing, because you wouldn't be able to see any of the light that comes out through here, right? So all the rain droplets, you mean like, not just in the double rainbow, just in general in the rainbow?
Yeah. It seems to work for only one rainbow, too.
Yeah. Just because because you get all this extra light in here that's reflected also through the raindrops.
Okay.
And you don't get it just by the raindrops.
Okay. So we have now a short break. But after the break, we'll meet back here at 3:15, and our first speaker will be Babak, who will also give us the answer to his psychological puzzle.